From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. China has done a great job in the past of restricting the press. Right now, it's a media madhouse. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to Orville Schell, one of the many journalists in China waiting for President Clinton to arrive. Schell has been writing about China since the 60s. We'll talk about how the Chinese are preparing for Clinton and trying to present the best face to the international press. We'll also look at some of the issues facing the president, profile his Chinese counterpart, and consider how the Asian economic meltdown is affecting China. Later, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a 2-CD set of demos and rough mixes recorded by Jeff Buckley before his death last year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The nation's largest long-distance phone company, AT&T, has agreed to buy TCI, the country's largest cable television company. The price, $48 million in stock and acquired debt. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The purchase of the big cable company by AT&T is aimed at getting the long-distance carrier into the local telephone and information delivery market. TCI has 10 million cable customers. However, it will cost about $2 billion for its lines to be upgraded for two-way phone service. That cost helped scuttle Bell Atlantic's bid for TCI back in 1993. But AT&T appears to be willing to pay the price for a foothold in the local market. In 1996, the Congress passed legislation it hoped would inject competition into local telephone markets by getting cable companies and long-distance carriers to go head-to-head with the baby bells. This acquisition would seem to be in line with congressional intent, but it will still require the approval of the Justice Department, the Federal Communications Commission, and state and local regulators. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
Chinese police authorities are watching Chinese dissidents very closely. President Clinton has just departed Washington for China, and Chinese authorities are increasing surveillance on activists. They want to prevent any disruptions during Mr. Clinton's visits. Human rights organizations are watching the president's trip, too. They would like to see if he will promote the cause of dissidents while traveling. Firefighters from as far away as California and Montana have joined the battle against wildfires in Florida. Those blazes have consumed at least 118,000 acres over the past few weeks. From Miami, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
More than 115 houses and other buildings have burned in the continuing fires. Many of these have been in isolated rural areas or on the fringes of small towns. But residents of Ormond Beach, 10 miles north of Daytona Beach on the state's east coast, have had their bags packed this week and some have been ordered to evacuate. New fires continue to break out. Florida emergency management officials counted 469 fires between Thursday and Monday. Most of these were started by lightning strikes from storms that have delivered little rain so far. Temperatures in the 90s and higher have persisted for weeks, fueling the fires. Forecasters predict a tropical weather system may bring some relief to the southern half of the state during the weekend. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
A British committee working to develop commemorative ideas for Princess Diana has chosen four items. The committee is backing a Diana medal for school children, a new commemorative coin, special nursing teams to aid children with life-threatening illnesses, and a memorial garden for the late Princess of Wales. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 24 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, telecommunications companies are among the stocks to watch on Wall Street today. High technology stocks are also continuing their climbs. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
At the noon hour, Wall Street, not surprisingly, is abuzz about the AT&T-TCI deal. Stock in TCI is up fairly sharply today on the news it'll be acquired by AT&T in a $48 billion stock deal. However, as is often the case when it comes to the acquiring company, shares of AT&T are lower, down more than $5 a share today. Technology stocks, meanwhile, continue to move higher, with traders apparently deciding at least for now the worst may be over for that sector of the market. Oil prices took a surprise dip following the announcement from OPEC. The cartel plans a production cut of more than a million barrels a day. That is a bigger cut than expected, but skepticism over whether the 11 countries that make up OPEC will comply with the cuts is apparently why prices fell rather than rose. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Members of Congress are preparing to unveil legislation that would widen taxpayers' rights while reining in the Internal Revenue Service. The House could pass the bill as early as tomorrow, and the Senate could adopt it after July 4th. The legislation would cost $13 billion over 10 years and give the IRS commissioner new powers to revamp the agency. The measure comes after controversial Senate hearings in which several taxpayers alleged abuse at the hands of IRS agents. The government's reporting a big drop in orders for expensive goods. The Commerce Department says orders to American factories for durable goods in May fell 2.6%. That's the largest decline in 5 months. Durable goods are expensive items intended to last at least 3 years, like cars and computers. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Orville Schell is in Xi'an, China, which will be the first stop on President Clinton's tour. Schell spent the past few days in Beijing. He's been writing about China since the 60s, so he's interested in seeing what the outcome of Clinton's visit will be. It marks the first time in a decade that an American president has gone to China. In Schell's books, such as Discos and Democracy, To Get Rich is Glorious, and Mandate of Heaven, he's followed the changes in China's politics, economy, and pop culture. He's also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and Newsweek, and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. We called him today at 8 a.m. East Coast time, which was 8 p.m. in Xi'an, which is in northwest China. Xi'an was the capital of China before it shifted to Beijing in the 17th century. Reporters from around the world are gathering in Xi'an. I asked Schell why he wants to be there.
Well, I think this is a pretty historic moment for many reasons, not the least of which is that Sino-American relations are trying to find some new high ground. And I think this return visit of Clinton is going to probably establish the relationship as it's known and in a way which will make it somewhat more durable. But also I think it's an important time because Asia is really on fire. I mean, it's an economic meltdown. And China, curiously, has been isolated and somewhat protected, somewhat smug, I might add, as well. Enough of its old Maoist apparatus still survives to protect it from a lot of the global influences that have really brought Indonesia to its knees, have brought Japan down, Thailand, Malaysia. But just lately, it started to jump the firewall in certain rather ominous ways. So I think this trip is a milestone both for Sino-U.S. relations and also it may be a real milestone for China, possibly coming to the end of these rather extraordinary economic boom years. And then, you know, many things could happen. Economics could trigger off a whole variety of sort of very tension-laden fault lines of a social and political nature.
What are some of the things that you see now in Xi'an or that you saw in Beijing before you got to Xi'an? In terms of, you know, welcoming President Clinton or preparing, are there posters around and people selling souvenirs and stuff?
Well, there are banners up. I mean, everything is sort of cleaned up. People are on their best behavior. You know, the police are removing any sort of underclass citizens that might be roaming around. They do gussy up the place. This is a big moment, and China's, you know, traditional yearning to play with the big boys, to be one of the great powers, is very much in evidence. And I think there's a certain insecurity in that regard. So when they get someone like Clinton to come and visit, appearances are extremely important, and particularly for their own people, because this is a country that really has very few sources of legitimization for its government besides economic well-being. And with that in a somewhat greater question now, One other obvious source is to have a big leader from the United States come and be seen on television, you know, reviewing Chinese troops, hobnobbing with its leaders. This is an imprimatur of legitimization, which the party leadership craves.
I think that's one of the things that's making Clinton's trip so controversial here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it is, because from the Chinese perspective, it's very clear what they want. They want this imprimatur of acceptance, not only the semblance that the U.S. has forgotten and forgiven for 1989, but, you know, China's 1.3 billion people, many of them, you know, very simple, ordinary people will see this on television, and they won't hear everything that is said, but it will be a very powerful symbol to them of China's having come of age and of the leadership, their leadership, appearing to be respected and accepted.
What do you think the Clinton administration wants to get out of this trip?
I think that's much vaguer. You know, in many respects, I think Clinton's trip here is a stage and a cast of characters without a real script. Whether they can write one while they're here is another question. I mean, Clinton's very good at that. But, you know, there's not much to be accomplished, or not much that anyone really expects will be accomplished. And, in fact, there's a funny feeling around Beijing of a certain lack of excitement in this trip. First of all, nobody quite knows why he's coming here except to, you know, make the relationship better. But also, it's a very long trip. It's 8 days. And people, even ordinary tourists, don't always come here for 8 days. So it's a kind of a slow-motion odyssey, as well as an odyssey with a very uncertain set of agenda items to be accomplished.
Another reason why President Clinton's trip is controversial here in America is because of allegations about the campaign money accepted from the Chinese military, controversy surrounding the sales of American communication satellite technology to the Chinese, technology that could be used for spying or military uses. So that's casting this trip in an even more controversial light.
Well, I mean, Clinton arrives. I mean, when you get into China and you're here a while, of course, all of these issues sort of vanish. The Chinese press doesn't say much about them, and when they do, they're cast in a very different light. You know, they're just sort of non-issues here in China because the press is controlled. But he's sort of coming out of this other world, this whirlpool of, you know, congressional bitterness over these things. And he will indeed have to say something about them and will indeed have to discuss them with China's leadership.
What is President Clinton's image now in China? And I don't mean on the part of the government, but if there's a popular image of him that's being conveyed in the press or in books.
Well, I think, you know, Clinton, like America, you know, apart, forgetting for a moment all of the various scandals that he's involved with, I think are considered in a rather friendly fashion by most Chinese. But beneath the surface, there has always been, you know, over the last century and a half, a potentially anti-foreign element in China that can be excited, a very nationalist element. And there have been numerous books written lately about, you know, the demonization of China by America, by various people in Congress, by various China experts, you know, by people who even care about such things as human rights, as if, you know, these people were out somehow to besmirch the good name of China just because they don't like China. So there's a sub sentiment beneath the basic you know, approval of the United States and I think fascination with the United States that is also very ambivalent.
I'm wondering how much you think the Chinese people know about the sexual allegations surrounding President Clinton in the United States and what they make of that.
Well, there was a book that came out and was quite popular that got into Clinton's life and many aspects of the recent scandals, and the government banned it. I guess they thought that Clinton was enough their man that they didn't want his good name sullied when they had the power to in large measure control the press. So that book did get banned. But there's a strong tradition here, even though the press is very much controlled, of once books are banned, they get published on a what they call the second channel, sort of underground, and they will come out and be sold in the little bookstores in the streets, and they'll be able to jack the price up, double the amount. Some of them may get confiscated. And, you know, it's very hard to say which of the editions was the banned edition, which was published afterwards in pirated form. So there's gotten to be a great deal of sort of subversive publishing that goes on, not exactly in the samizdat form that we were familiar with in the Soviet Union, but it's more commercial.
More like pirated videos or the kind of stuff that street vendors sell here in the States.
Exactly. And it's market-driven. And people were interested in Clinton. And you know, I think many Chinese think, oh, what the heck, you know, leaders, strong leaders, like ladies, and, you know, no big deal. In fact, they may like it a little bit. Don't forget they had Chairman Mao, who was rather fond of the ladies himself.
President Clinton will be meeting with his Chinese counterpart, President and Party Chief Jiang Zemin. Who is he?
Well, he is the president of the People's Republic of China currently and the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. And he is a curious man that people know very, very little about. Part of the reason they know little about him is because his life was not that interesting. He is a technocrat. He grew up in a rather aristocratic family in the Yangtze River Valley and studied music and, you know, poetry and had a little dose of traditional Chinese culture before the revolution came, then was schooled in Shanghai, and also had a flirtation with student demonstrations, both against the Japanese and then against Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. But he seems at every occasion to have somehow dodged the bullet and never been particularly passionately committed to Marxism, although he was a revolutionary, joined the party in 1947, and not particularly passionately identified with any one faction during any of the political movements that swept China, but sort of went along. His first job was at strangely enough, in an American canned food factory that made a popsicle called the Lovely Lady Popsicle. And then he went on to a automobile manufacturing plant in Manchuria, did a year in Moscow at the Stalin Motor Works, went to Romania for almost a year to do some industrial projects. So he's not a very, doesn't have a very exciting pedigree.
And wasn't a career politician.
He wasn't a career politician, but sort of worked his way up through various ministries of electronic machinery and whatnot, and then got to be mayor and party chief of Shanghai. And after the 1989 massacre, and after the second of two party chiefs were cashiered, he was summoned to Beijing to take over.
What does he stand for politically?
Well, many people describe him as belonging to the Feng Pai, which means the wind faction, meaning that he blows in whatever direction the breeze is blowing. He's been pretty good at surviving. It's very hard to know what he stands for. I mean, he doesn't seem to be a tremendously ardent revolutionary or Marxist or really in any categories. But he manages to be a good consensus builder. He doesn't play factions, which don't seem to antagonize people against him. He in some curious way, reminds me of that sort of Peter Sellers film of just being there. He's just sort of there, not very dynamic, but seems to run the ship okay, and maybe that's what China needs after having all of these gargantuan figures like Chairman Mao and Deng Xiaoping is just a good technocrat.
My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's in Xi'an, China, waiting for President Clinton, who's on his way. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Orville Schell is joining us, and he's a journalist who's been covering China since the 1960s. He's joining us by phone, but from Xi'an in China. President Clinton will be received at a ceremony in Tiananmen Square, which was, of course, the site of the pro-democracy protests in 1989 that led to the government massacre. The Congress in the United States passed a non-binding measure demanding that Clinton avoid Tiananmen Square on his trip. Is the location controversial in China, too, among human rights activists?
Well, I think there are many people who either lost somebody in the massacre in 1989 or who have been to prison, who have run afoul of the government in some way over the last few decades, who do feel that it's an affront to have Clinton be received there. He is going to be received on the east steps, east plaza of the Great Hall of the People, which flanks the western side of the square. And it was on those steps, paradoxically, that students in April of 1989 kneeled in supplication to their government, raising up a petition of grievances to the premier and to the government, much as people used to do in traditional times, you know, very passive, supplicating way. And of course, they were rebuked and nobody received it. It was a kind of a very painful action to watch because it was sort of so humiliating and submissive. And it was also from these steps that the troops came out of the Great Hall of the People on the night of June 4th to finally move the students out of the monument to the people's heroes in the very center of the square in front of Mao's mausoleum, which ended the 6-7 weeks of protests. So it's a place that's fraught with great significance. And, you know, the whole square, I mean, Tiananmen Square is a really fascinating place. And I think you'd have to say that if the soul of China resides anywhere in Beijing and in China, it is in this amazing square, which is larger than Red Square, that faces the Gate of Heavenly Peace into the Forbidden City, with Mao's mausoleum at the other end. And it has always been, in modern times, to the square the Chinese have come to seek a redress of grievances. And this started in the May 4th incident in 1919 when Japanese acquired German concessions in China after the First World War, and China's first modern demonstration flocked through the square demanding that the warlord government of the time not accede to these demands. One person was finally killed, and that was it. But this echoed down through decades afterwards and turned into the May 4th movement, which was really advocating democracy and science. And ever since then, people feel that their protests are only legitimized when they reach the square. The square was first bathed in blood in 1926 when a protest against Japan reached the Gate of Heavenly Peace, and the warlord then in power fired on the crowd and killed 50 people, wounded 100. And China's most famous writer, Lu Xun, made a wonderful quote. He said that, lies written in ink will never disguise truths written in blood. And then he went on to say, in a very prophetic way, in terms of 1989, that, you know, the longer they are due, the greater the debt. And so it's all of this that is in the minds of Chinese as they now countenance the American president coming to the square. What he's thinking of is 1989, but what Chinese are thinking of is a whole century of significance that the square has acquired.
So for, are you saying it seems like an appropriate place to receive the president to most Chinese?
Well, appropriate on the one hand and inappropriate on the other. I mean, like so much of what's going on in China these days, it's a conundrum and a contradiction. Of course, it's appropriate because it is where the Great Hall of the People, which is the sort of the White House and the Congress rolled into one, is situated, but inappropriate because there's been a struggle historically going on for the possession of this square's identity, whether it's a place of state power or as a place of remonstration. And in a certain very symbolic and powerful way, Clinton going there stamps the square or condones the square on the side of state power rather than its sort of alternative identity, which is as a site of redress of grievances and protest.
Do you think that there's anything President Clinton can say during his address in Tiananmen Square to address human rights?
Well, the problem is that he doesn't get to say anything in Tiananmen Square. This is, you know, reviewing the honor guard. It's all ritual and ceremony. So, I mean, I think he would love to say something. A friend of mine suggested that he should wear black and Hillary should wear white, which is white is the traditional funeral color, and everybody would get the point. Or when the Italian prime minister was here 2 weeks ago or so, he actually did something very symbolic. He went into the square, asked to go alone, and he stopped and he said a prayer for those who had all the heroes who had passed through the square in history. And, I mean, that was sort of fighting symbols with symbols, and Clinton will have to think of some way to, you know, at least symbolically make his sentiments known, since he doesn't get to say anything until really a day and a half later when he's going to give his big speech at Beijing University. And then I think he's going to really unload. But as I say, I think this will not be broadcast live, and Chinese will probably not get the full version.
Orville Schell spoke to us from Xi'an, China. He's the author of several books about China, including Discos and Democracy and Mandate of Heaven. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Orville Schell, who's in China to cover President Clinton's trip. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a 2-CD set of demos and rough mixes recorded by Jeff Buckley before his death last year. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton is on his way to China. Earlier today, we called journalist Orville Schell, who's in Xi'an, which is the first stop on the president's trip. Schell will be covering the presidential visit and the carnival surrounding it. He's been writing about China since the 60s. He's the author of several books about China and has written about the country for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and Newsweek. A few years ago, you wrote a book called Discos and Democracy that was about China's new business economy after it had opened its doors a little bit more to the outside world. And you were writing how this new business and economic life was affecting every aspect of Chinese life, including pop culture. And you documented a lot of new things that were coming to China, kind of odd juxtapositions like golf courses and music. And I wonder what you've been seeing now that's been added since then. Anything unusual in culture or pop culture?
Well, there are some interesting things that are going on, culturally speaking. But I think my predominant impression, Terry, is that, you know, culture is really on the run in China. And it is a bit depressing to somebody who is not a businessman, such as myself. I mean, one of the things that has always made China fascinating to me is that culture, and particularly pop culture, is a kind of surrogate form of political expression. In a society where you cannot be direct and politically say exactly what you mean or demonstrate how you feel, culture and pop culture become a way of indirectly expressing it. But in the last decade, since 1989, the party, very astutely, I think, by unleashing market forces in such a powerful way, has had a very powerfully defoliating effect on culture. It's almost as if culture is not interesting anymore to enough people because it can't make money. And what's supreme now is wealth. So culture seems sort of boring, particularly traditional forms of culture, whether it's literature, art, or history, you just make no money at all, and so people aren't drawn to them. Popular culture, you know, there's a fairly robust punk rock scene in China here now. There's some interesting filmmakers and art, but it's very nihilistic and very sort of cold, and it's not exactly uplifting, but it's interesting.
What are some of the signs that China is being affected by the economic meltdown in Asia? Is the standard of living noticeably changing? Can you just see signs of this on the street?
Well, I mean, there are two things going on out here. I mean, the first thing is that there's this meltdown, and it's sort of like rumors of distant wars that's going on in the rest of Asia. And this is affecting China. It's lowering its growth rate. It's making it more difficult for it to export things. But there's another whole drama going on within the country, which is China trying to reform the old state-owned enterprises, the socialist centralized part of its economy. And to do that, they're having to lay off millions of people. These are the big industries that were set up back in the era when China was following the Soviet Union and Stalin was a big brother and these giant state-owned, ministry-run industries were built that had cafeterias, schools, hospitals. I mean, they were like complete living centers for people. Most of them now are obsolete, can't produce anything, and yet they have, you know, millions of workers in them. So the reforms are trying to either bankrupt them, merge them, privatize them, do something to get them off the public payroll. And one of the things they're doing is they're sidelining workers. It means they give them a little money and they just sort of let them go. Well, the streets are filled with these people now, you know, trying to sell things on little carts or just on the sidewalk. In a hotel that I stayed at in Beijing, I started talking to the women who clean the rooms. It turned out they used to hire younger women, pay them 1,600 Chinese yuan a month, but they fired them all, and they hired these people who've been sidelined at 400 yuan a month, a quarter. And these were older women who had, you know, they were rather desperate. They'd been let go from their other jobs. So this is the other drama that's going on. The problem of China trying to marketize and privatize and reform that part of its economy, which is still in the past, even as its private side has sort of raced forward and, you know, gotten Armani suits and high-rise buildings and, you know, all of the affectations of the outside world. There's still this refractory part of China that remains unreconstructed.
So there are more people who are clearly becoming winners and losers now that communism has been altered, or that communism has been transformed to whatever it's called now in China.
Well, there has been a kind of counter-revolution that's gone on, although God forbid they don't use that name.
So some people are getting really wealthy now with the new economic system, while others are losing their job and not working at all or working for next to nothing.
It's a kind of a Marxist nightmare. You know, the exploiting classes are truly back, and there's a delamination of society into the wealthy and the poor. And this is all right and has worked for the last 10 years because the house has been going on fire. I mean, it's such a rapid rate of development that everybody has a faint expectation that they can work their way up. So the real danger now comes when the prospect of the meltdown in Asia outside affecting China, and China desperately trying to reform the old parts of its economy, conspire to create an expectation that things are going to be going slower and slower and maybe hardly moving at all. So these people at the bottom then might not have any grounds for optimism that they can move up. And this is something that really does make the leaders extremely fearful.
Now that there seems to be this new sense of class in China and a growing disparity between the people who are the nouveau riche in China and the people who are becoming poor in China because they've lost their jobs with the end of state-run industries. Do you think people are feeling, are kind of remembering at all what it was like before communism in China in the feudal days and what class divisions were like then?
I think in many ways, you know, what's shaping up in China very much harkens back to the way things were before the revolution came to power in 1949, the way in which people are being exploited in factories, the sex industry, women, I mean, being swept up into this nightmare, drugs are coming back, there are gangs that are trafficking in children, women, you know, organs for transplant, one thing or another. I mean, very similar phenomena reappearing. And, you know, people are also looking back somewhat nostalgically to the very early years of the revolution in the 50s, when the thing still had a belief system and was credible and still evoked hope and a sense of optimism in the future. There is a sort of a level of cynicism that has crept in, and certainly communism as an ideology evokes absolutely no sense of belief in anybody. So it really is a regime at this point whose credibility and legitimacy rests on its ability to produce economically. And that's why this is so crucial. And that's why this moment, when Clinton is here, does kind of mark the watershed when the combination of economic forces within the country are slowing down and maybe hindered even further by what's going on in the rest of Asia.
My guest is journalist Orville Schell. He's in Xi'an, China, the first city that President Clinton will visit on his tour. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Orville Schell, and he's in Xi'an, China, awaiting the visit of President Clinton. You probably didn't see this because it was printed in the Times after you left for China, but Mobile had an ad in the New York Times. I don't know, it might have been in other newspapers too. And the headline of this ad was "Opening More Doors with China." And the rest of the ad was kind of like a little editorial that Mobile wrote. And part of it reads, "China has entered a new era of growth and development. The U.S. and others can choose to be partners in that growth and work constructively for progress, or they can turn their backs on a nation that is home to 22% of the world's people. We believe the answer is clear. It's time to open more doors." And I wonder how you see multinationals now as players in the United States' relationship with China.
Well, I mean, I think the multinationals have been very sort of eager not to have the boat rocked because they're all looking for deals. The truth is they haven't gotten a whole lot of deals, not as many as they thought they'd get. You know, the nuclear industry thought they'd do great when sanctions were lifted a year ago, and they really haven't gotten anything. Boeing's had an up-and-down history. Motorola, which was the big example of American company doing very well, is now on hard times. I think that, you know, it's well and good to open doors and be engaged, and I think it's very important that we do that with China. But I also think it's a bit unseemly when corporations sort of mau-mau our government into silence as well on a host of other important issues, which traditionally have been in the bouquet of policy concerns that America has stood for. So I think everybody's going to be watching very carefully to see what Clinton says. One of the issues which I went to a press conference that the Chinese foreign minister gave the other day, and one of the issues on minds of the Western press was, why doesn't Clinton have the ability, as Reagan demanded when he went to the Soviet Union, to speak to the Chinese people during a time when he what he says would not be edited or censored? And I think they have not yet agreed to that. And, you know, from the point of view of many corporations, this would be destabilizing, and they would not like to see this happen. My own view is that we should trade. We shouldn't sanction China. We shouldn't threaten them with MFN. But on the other hand, we shouldn't be intimidated either into being who we are and what we believe in and saying it very loudly and clearly.
What's on the human rights agenda for this trip?
Well, I'm afraid not too much. There will be much private discussion, probably much less public discussion. The prevailing view in Washington is that, you know, you humiliate China by raising these issues publicly and you get nowhere, but you may get somewhere if you do it quietly and politely behind closed doors. Again, I must say that my view is that you shouldn't tiptoe around these issues. You should be polite and respectful, but we have an absolute division on this question. And I think Clinton will say something in public, but I don't think the Chinese people will hear it because it won't be broadcast to them. And in a certain sense, they're as important an audience as Americans are. I mean, this is, after all, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that does say that no human being should be tried without due process or tortured or to suffer consequences of exercising peaceful free speech. So I think that, you know, Clinton has been, there's a limited number of arrows in his quiver on this subject, and some of them he may not choose to pull out. I think he will not meet with any dissidents. For instance, a mother of one of the students who was shot and killed on June 4th, Ding Zilin, is very ardent and refuses to shut up. And in fact, because the government will not release a list of the people who were killed and wounded that night, she has set about making up her own list. And it would be provocative to be sure, but maybe fitting as well if the President of the United States asked to be able to speak with such people.
I want to get back to the economy for a second. Do you think that there are things that China has done as the economic meltdown spreads that's different from the way authoritarian capitalist countries in Asia have been handling the economic crisis?
Well, You know, in certain ways, China's protected precisely because it hasn't opened up. You know, its currency's not convertible. It hasn't taken a lot of short-term loans the way Thailand and Korea have. So in this sense, its old autarkic, authoritarian regime that didn't look kindly on mixing China's economy with the outside world. The old motto when I first came here in 1975 was Zili Gengsheng, self-reliance. Now what's happening more recently, the globalization of everything, including parts of the Chinese economy, would have been an anathema to Chairman Mao and an anathema to the revolution back then. So in a certain sense, there isn't so many things. They're caught between different identities and different philosophies of who they are and where they're going. And you know, I think one of the real problems of China is that nobody knows where they're going. You ask somebody, what's the model? You know, what are you trying to become? When it's all done, what's it going to look like? And nobody has a ghost of an idea. It's just going like hell, but nobody quite knows where it's going. And nobody quite dares define it, because to define the new model, the new goal, would be, in a sense, to cashier the old one. And here we still have Mao Zedong's portrait hanging on the Gate of Heavenly Peace in Tiananmen Square. And to redefine the future would be to cashier the past, and then you'd have to take down Chairman Mao's portrait. And then you'd have to remove his, you know, taxidermized remains from his mausoleum, and then, you know, what have you. Well, then you have no rationalization for the Chinese Communist Party ruling unilaterally. So it's a real dilemma that centers around identity questions that China just doesn't want to address right at this moment. And they don't want to go back and do what Clinton has suggested, which is, you know, get on the right side of history, because to do that would be to undermine the whole of the revolution.
Orville, I'm wondering if you could make a quick comparison for us between what China was like the first time you visited the country and what it looks like, do you know?
You know, the difference is just staggering. I can hardly believe, as I go down the streets of Beijing or Shanghai, what I see. And I also should tell you, I hardly know where I am. In a city, you know, I was thinking the other night as I was walking down Wangfujing, one of the main streets, and there wasn't a building in the street I recognized. And a landmark now in China is a building that was built 10 years ago. It's changing that fast. And one level, it's just staggeringly impressive. And the changes are real. People's lives are much freer. They are much more normal and relaxed. And yet, on the other hand, there are big chunks of China sort of beneath the surface that remain still frozen in the past. And it's this kind of curious contradiction that makes it so hard to come to any conclusion about the place, much less to describe it coherently, because it, in a way, isn't coherent. But the changes are just extraordinary and breathtaking, and the energy with which China has gone about them, I think, you know, deserves everybody's admiration. But it's a little frightening, a little terrifying to find a country changing so rapidly. You feel almost like, you know, Peer Gynt peeling the onion. You know, there's no center there. People don't quite know how to answer that, you know, very Monty Pythonish question of the meaning of life. Lots is happening, but how does it add up to equal the good life or a new good life? Well, Chinese are just still at the material phase of answering that question and really haven't gotten to some of the more complex parts of it.
You speak Chinese, yes?
Yes.
Have you heard anything that you think you were maybe not supposed to hear?
You know, it's interesting. People actually speak very freely now in private. And many times, I mean, once you get them going, you can't stop them. So there isn't quite as much of a cat-and-mouse game that goes on as there used to be. It's simply a question of you know, getting them in the proper proximity where they don't fear that they'll be overheard or in some sense what they say will get back. But, I mean, this is one of the really striking changes, is the openness with which people vent their spleens or with which they're funny or direct or sincere in private. It used to be, when I first got here, I mean, it was such a chilly atmosphere. Nobody would say anything. There was no really realm of the private. People didn't have private relations because they were too risky. You just couldn't afford to say things to people because you never knew who would report on you. This is not the case now. So the circumference of dialogue where people feel fearful about speaking out loud is much smaller and centers much more around official politics and the circumference of freedom to speak out your private sentiments is also much larger, but it is more private.
Well, we hope to talk again at the end of your trip.
Great.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us, Orville.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Orville Schell spoke to us from Xi'an, China. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Schell is the author of several books about China and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, demos and rough mixes recorded by singer-songwriter and guitarist Jeff Buckley before his death last year. This is Fresh Air. When Jeff Buckley drowned and died in May 1997 at the age of 31, he'd released just one full-length album, 1994's Grace. But he was hard at work on a follow-up collection, which he intended to call For My Sweetheart the Drunk. Working with the cooperation of Buckley's mother, his record company has just put together a 2-CD set called Sketches for My Sweetheart the Drunk, consisting of finished demos and rough mix tracks Buckley had recorded. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Like to see him suffer for your fantasy and thrill. He fell sick while we made love. He's out there somewhere still. Oh, I feel the spell that you have cast. Hot, pink, nasty bubblegum.
Jeff Buckley was the son of Tim Buckley, an ethereally gifted 60s songwriter who was a junkie, a suicide, and a largely absent father to whom his son disliked being compared. By all accounts, Jeff was a disciplined musician who knew how to tap into his free-spirited side with a canny prose adroitness. His debut album, Grace, featured many lovely melodies that circumvented conventional pop structures, and these, combined with his soulful good looks and the death legend of his father, put him on the track for a stardom that might have cut deeper than most. Certainly, the new songs he was working on were mysterious, sinuous, and alluring.
Through the yard, of blonde girls. Through the river and the sea, gold sharks glittering, a tree of the earth, the streets were on a plane, very sexy.
first disc on Sketches for My Sweetheart the Drunk consists of demos produced by Tom Verlaine, the guitarist for the great New York punk band Television. The liner notes for the collection by the journalist Bill Flanagan say that Buckley wasn't entirely pleased with their sound. But it seems hard to imagine a good tune like Nightmares by the Sea achieving a level higher than it does here.
Beware the bottled thoughts of angry young men. Secret compartments hide all of the skeletons. Little girl wants to make a home with him. In the middle of the shore, she wonders. Don't know what she asks for. What you ask for. When all young lovers know why nightmares blind their mind's eye. Yeah, little bitch young and handsome, so new to your bedroom floor. In a damn world where you go.
The music on the second disc here is often very rough material indeed. It's hard to know how to appreciate a noisy, nattering, aimless piece like this, called Murder, Suicide, Meteor, Slave, other than to hope that Buckley might have left a tape of it in a drawer of well-meaning failures.
Someone has to pay for the damage done. No one's gonna love you now. To it all now.
The second disc has its moments, as when Buckley starts strumming thick power chords and yelling the title Your Flesh Is So Nice over and over with punky catharsis. But that's just a curiosity. You cringe a little for Buckley, for having its rawness exposed to the world. But there's also no doubt that, based on the uneven but rich and varied music spread over this double disc set, that Jeff Buckley would have been a maddening, exhilarating, always compelling singer-songwriter to follow for years into the new century.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air is produced this week by Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Fred Snyder was our engineer today. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Time takes care of the wound, so I can believe you had so much to give, you thought I couldn't see.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.